All right, good morning and welcome. Coming at you live from Belgrade, Serbia. This is XF. We have a war update, news roundup on all the fronts in the conflict in Ukraine. Going to be talking about that. We got about a two-hour broadcast for you coming up today, so get comfortable. We're going to be bringing on our special guest. We're going to call him Y. Goes by you, but we're going to call him Y, or you. You'll see him as someone who is a known documented stalker in our comment section. Just kidding. But you'll find him often interacting, posting off weird stuff or informative things. But as a person, as a character, as a biography, the man has much more to say, has more of a background. But sometimes graces us with his humor in the comment section. We're just going to call him you. We're not going to talk about who's who. We can't always do that. Too much glow, too many spooks. But let me start up as he pulls his notes together. And he can introduce himself when he comes on in a minute here. Tell us a little bit about his background. But we're just going to look at we're going to frame this a little bit before we bring him on. So when you look at this conflict, and I follow this every day, I don't talk with you guys about everything I see every day, because all of you listening are following some aspect of it. If you want more, or if you just want kind of like the essentials, with me, you get the essentials. In other words, I don't miss things that I find important, but I do not report on, I'm not a reporter. Yeah? I don't talk about a lot of things that I think are just the daily events, right? I mean, there are some dailies that I like to get into, just kind of like the tallies by the numbers, just to be consistent. But there isn't always a lot of things, and a lot of it is subjective. I'm not always in the mood just to see like stuff getting blowed up. And sometimes it's just footage of things getting blowed up and you share that because it's interesting at the time. But the things happening in the conflict that are really opening up, and I feel like in terms of the audience retention, a lot of people kind of, all right, yeah, Russia's in there, Russia's winning. And then they'll check in, like, what's going on? And they'll check in, like, 2-3 times a week, or, they'll put 5 minutes in once a day just to kind of figure out, like, what's the score. And what they're seeing, if they're following still, is that Russia ain't stopping. Yeah. It's, like, continuing. It's, like, growing and growing in this. You can see these little territorial just a few kilometers, like 3 kilometers, 7 kilometers. But when you zoom in kind of microscopically on the various fronts, if you look at the big map, it doesn't look like much is moving until it does, right? Like if you compare them like by many weeks, like by like 5 weeks, you can see. But when you get granular, you can see this movement. And then by the movement, you see like what's coming. Also, you can see what's coming by like where they are attriting. Hey, it's kind of weird how much they are attriting in certain places. I mean, attacking artillery, war by attrition, in all kinds of places. And you're, that's what's next. The Kharkov region is definitely going to be a Russian region. We've said that. We've already gone out and said it. It's definitely going to be a Russian region. And we're going to talk about the other developments on the front coming up. In this great show for you, we're going to run, like I said, about 2 hours, an hour 45. We're going to bring on our dude now, Y, and let's see if we can get this to work. Okay, Y, you, if you can hear me, just like indicate that you like wave your hand to come on the show.
Hello.
Works. You can just speak anytime.
Hello. Can we hear each other? Can we hear each other? I'm talking, but I don't know if you can hear me.
I'm having some audio problem where my, actually this is an issue with the mic. It doesn't like, so hold on, brother, just hold on. My mic doesn't like when I, me to hear anything. It's a stupid, let me see here.
All right.
All right, go on. Go on. Yeah, I got you now. Yeah. Minor technological difficulty, but we got it now. So go on.
Good morning, Vietnam.
Good morning, Vietnam.
All right. So,
tell us about some of your background. We're going to talk about the war in depth today, and we're going to talk about what's happening on each of the fronts.
All right. Well, long story short, I'm about 37 years old, and ever since I was a kid, which means since I was about seven, I've been watching, the propaganda tale being spun around the world about how there's the good guys and the bad guys. And I was most of the time on the side of the bad guys due to my ethnicity and my background. So with the breakup of Yugoslavia, which you may or may not be familiar with to whatever extent, the Serbs were always the bad guys, and by birth I was a Serb, even though by blood I'm not technically a Serb, but by birth I was a Serb. So I was always the Muslim killer for about a decade in the 90s, and the more you look into it and the older I got, the more it turned out that 98% of it was just a narrative and just CNN. So I have, let's say, 3 decades of deciphering propaganda experience. And it's unbelievable to see the same spiel, the same talking points, the same accusatory bullshit basically being spewed all the time. And it's always the same. It's just going around in circles.
Yeah, we have a thing we like to do here. It's the all I need to know about this conflict meme. It's sort of like when you have another time that these usual suspects like George or Alex Soros or any of these people, and they come out and say, and they always land on the same side of things. And it's always like a reality check. I'm like, okay, good. I'm still on the other side of this subject, like from these most notoriously evil people. So that's kind of all I need to know about the conflict is
right.
Which are these guys on, right?
Yep.
And they have the same attitude. So they're saying everybody be support Ukraine or until it's time to blame them for their own failures. And then the same people are saying, and everyone against the Serbs. It's the same people. Yeah.
It's not only the Serbs, it's also Iran, it's also Iraq, it's also Libya, it's also Syria. You know, it's like all over the world, and it's always the sovereign, independent, secular society that gets bombed. You know, like any country basically that has its independence and its willpower and its ability to say no, needed to be taken out, better to say. But like after this special operation, they're going to be thinking twice about whether they're going to be taking out random countries. That would be my deduction.
If we were to like trace the trajectory of the development in the counter-hegemonic forces or the decline of the power of the New World Order, I would say, like, I would put it like definitively when you saw like, wow, this is big. I would say when strangely, for no apparent reason, then British Prime Minister Cameron declined Obama's request to engage in kinetic aerial attack strikes on Syrian targets, which would have probably started World War III at the time. And in an unprecedented move, delegated that to be a vote held in the parliament. And then again, surprisingly, once again, parliament declined authorization for attack on Syria. from England. That was 2013. We've seen paradigm shifting developments ever since then. Take it from there.
Syria is a good example, but I think Libya, I'm not sure about the timeline. I'm not sure whether it was before or after. I think it was before then. But the
like 2 years, the point, yeah.
But the point is that that Libya as well, like when the Russians basically came into Libya and played the role of a bodyguard basically to the Benghazi government, that was split, let's say, in the east-west, that basically showed that they weren't going to take any shit anymore. They were going to basically back up their talk with some security.
And I guess we still have the conflict there with Haftar, and I guess we have the Turks on one side and the French and Russians on another.
You know, I used to know some Libyans, and they generally speaking were happy with what they had. There was a small minority that weren't. But during the liberation of Libya and the lynching of Gaddafi, the general consensus was like, oh, it's going to be better. Democracy is going to come. Freedom. Let's go tourism in Libya. You know, like I remember that summer right after the bombing or the liberation or the killing of Gaddafi. There was like a huge surge in like, go to Libya, it's safe for tourism, you know what I mean? And that didn't last.
There were some 50,000 Serbs in Libya at the time of the attack in 2010-11. Why so many Serbs in Libya?
From my understanding, Serbia as the inheritor of the Yugoslav tradition, let's put it that way.
You mean like non-aligned movement?
Yeah, but more than that, the ministry, the military industrial complex of Serbia and so on, took over basically from the Yugoslav one. And they were supplying, I think, even up to the actual days of the Gaddafi conflict, they were supplying the Libyan government with all kinds of things.
Now, when we look at the conflict happening right now, and you're following a lot of the... Now, you actually have a lot of familiarity analyzing aerial topography from the view of camera. You're actually very experienced in this. So, contrary to like many other people, you're in a unique position to look at things from, you know, from drones, for example, an area of your expertise or high proficiency. You're able to look at drone aerial imagery. You're able to look at maybe sometimes satellite photography when it's similar and make some conclusions about what you're looking at. You're following in depth a lot of the stuff from the hilarious and very consistent Defense Policy Asia report, and you is a hilarious guy, very consistent, comes on every day, talk about the developments on the front, you look at what he's saying, and what are you gleaning from all that? Where are the fronts? What's happening right now?
It's interesting to note that you know, most of the commentators, military or otherwise, will tell you, oh, Russia's failing, Russia sucks, Russia's slow, Russia's not making any progress. And the bottom line is that you have to keep in mind that it's been, well, at least in the Donbass area or Luhansk and Donetsk surroundings, let's put it that way, the entrenchments have been built, fortified, and dug in for about 8 years. So you have to keep in mind that, like, you know, you can go and, you know, just bomb everything. But right after that, you're still going to have to go in on foot and clear things. And the thing about the Russian tactic, from what I can see, is that once the front line moves up, the internal security forces take over. And they seem to be doing a pretty good job of cleaning up behind. When I say cleaning up, I mean any strangling negative elements that are lingering behind. But that's generally on that one front. If you wanna jump into the subject, so to say, it's been only 15 minutes. We can go through some points. There's you know, a couple of categories about this conflict that need to be elaborated on before we can talk about, you know, who's winning and why they're winning on the battlefield. One of those is history, and then we could go on to the battles.
Well, yeah, give us, start with how you want, and then you know, I'll jump in at, you know, randomly, if not rudely.
Rudely's fine. We can all remember the bombing that happened yesterday of the, or was it before yesterday? Before yesterday?
Of the market.
Of the market with the cluster munition. And that, unfortunately, is not something new in our history, you know? It's not like weddings weren't hit in Pakistan. And this kind of tactic of making people scared and getting the public to try and bring down the leadership of X country, whatever it be, is a tactic that's been used by the same side, let's say, for many, many years, including in Yugoslavia, like in all of the Serbian chats yesterday and the day before. The topic was basically like, oh my God, they're still doing the same thing. Because in Niš, I believe it was, the U.S. on a Sunday dropped bombs. Well, I don't know if it was a U.S. pilot, but it was a NATO, designated plane that dropped cluster munitions. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're coming in great.
All right, because I'm having some little notifications here. Anyway, so the point is the cluster munitions have been used before, and the civilian deaths have been used as a tactic or as a strategy to, like, get the civilian populace to give in to outside pressure and to put pressure onto the leader of their country. But this rarely works. In fact, it usually solidifies support for the actual government that's in play, and it's been used everywhere. Another thing that I should mention also about my history is that I grew up in Kuwait for a while, and that gives me kind of an interesting perspective on the Kuwait issue. I don't know how much your audience might or might not be familiar with it, but to a long story short, Saddam was told by the CIA that he can go in to Kuwait and take the oil that the Kuwaitis, quote unquote, were stealing. So he went in.
If I recall correctly, there was an allegation of diagonal drilling.
That's it. It's diagonal drilling / sloped reservoir underwater,
right?
And basically the one side of the border was deeper, so the Kuwaitis were supposedly sucking the oil from Iraq, and that was the justification, or at least the official justification. And if anybody's interested into hearing or seeing more about it, there's a great BBC documentary on YouTube called The Last Flight to Kuwait, where they show British quote-unquote mercenaries or forward operating troops going into Kuwait and being sent in with, like, a British Airways flight, and the British Airways flight goes in and disobeys air traffic control, disobeys a few other things, and goes in and becomes the last flight to Kuwait before the war. It delivers the special op troops and gets a few other civilians shot, you know, but it's worth it because they're the good guys. And then there's, of course, the retreat from Kuwait, where, you know, Schwarzkopf, I think his name is, caught up with Saddam, and they sat down in a tent in the desert, and they said, it's okay, it's fine, we'll kill you in about 6 to 7 years. And then they let him go back to Kuwait.
I mean, back to Iraq, and then, you know, a couple of years later was Iraq, the invasion, and then a couple of years after that was Iraq 2.
You're right.
And it's the same modus operandi everywhere. And now another little thing about history, which, you know, the Western audience rarely pays attention to, let's put it that way. The Western audience, you know, due to Hollywood and history being written the way it was and so on, the memory, let's say, of World War II is that it was Nazis against Jews, you know, but the bottom line is that it was actually Nazis against Russians. Because,
well, you're saying the geopolitical, there was not a geopolitical aim against Jewish people. The genocidal stuff was connected, but the aims of the war, I mean, the genocidal stuff could be accomplished in any number of ways, and the war was a vehicle. But the geopolitical aims of the conquest of Russia for Germany as Lebensraum was a critical part of the German platform at the time.
Of the Nazi platform, yeah.
Of the Nazi platform, but the German, you know, it was the German authorities. I mean, it was, that's who had legitimacy. Yeah. You know, you get Carl Schmitt and legitimacy of the state. I mean, to say it wasn't the Germans is, it doesn't mean that every German, you know what I mean, was for it.
Cut the long story short, if you just look at the deaths, if you just look at the totals are like, I think, if you look at the Slav totals, including the Serbian, and especially if you take it as part of the total population before pre-war, and the percentage that died, both civilian and military, if you look at the Yugoslav population and you look at the Russian population, they are the highest amount of casualties. Full stop. All right, that has to be always kept in mind.
You know, correct. Let me jump in here and just reintroduce. Good morning, folks. XF here. We're talking with YU. We're not going to say who he is, but he pops up on occasion in the comment section. We're talking about some of the developments on the war front. Right now, we are talking about the history of misunderstanding the Russian war aims in Ukraine. We're talking about the history of misunderstanding the approach. And the way we're doing that is we're talking about in the cabals, imperial wars for empire, they did not take account for high regard for human lives unless it served some kind of, you know, very specific peacekeeping, you know, tactical interest in the situation where they had to do more like police work and they needed like support from communities that they were occupying. That's a very, you know, that's a different tactic. But in terms of their use of munitions, cluster bombs, air force and things like that in order to achieve an occupation, they did not have regard for the number of human beings that were killed in those operations and therefore had free hand to level whole areas. Now, leveling by using their air superiority, not primarily to attack troops or to defend the move or to defend their you know, anti-air or to defend their troop movements, but actually to bomb civilian areas that were, you know, military may have been also, but without distinguishing between the two or using the type of munitions that are known that cannot, in fact, be more targeted. And by the way, that's just, we talk about this in the language of conflict and the rules of war. I mean, there are differences in terms of these things, but the idea of high accuracy, you know, you wouldn't miss so many times, right? Like before hitting your target, if they were highly, highly accurate. So obviously, there are unintentional civilian losses for Ukraine caused by Russian forces. That is a real phenomenon, and it's a horrible thing. The political costs are very high as well for Russia. It makes people who were neutral be anti-Russia. These things happen, but they were happening earlier on. Now the A lot of the fighting, a lot of the attriting is occurring in the field. Certain things in the conflict have changed, but conventionally speaking, when we heard Russia at the UN, they did not, in fact, say that no Ukrainian civilians had died as a result of the Russian operation. Rather, that these did not constitute the level of war crimes, because there was not negligence, indiscrimination, or even targeting, genocide, etc. But even in the minimal criteria for it to be a war crime, in other words, there's a recognition that civilians die in war. It's an awful thing. It's a horrible thing. Those are actually his words, in fact. Folks, welcome again. We're talking to you, Y, and we're not going to say exactly who he is. And so we've been explaining how in the history of these wars, the wars for empire, that the cabal did not take high consideration for human life. Now, at the beginning, the top of the hour, or no, sorry, starting at around 9:35, we began to talk. And at that time, our guest was saying that a lot of the Western experts are saying that, hey, Russia is losing this conflict because they're winning in slow motion. And so now let's talk about their methods and why the different reasons why their pushes have taken the time despite everything else. Take it from there.
Why they've taken their time? Well, we should go back to like the first weeks of the opening of the war, and we should discuss combat reconnaissance, because even though military experts like Scott Ritter and others have clearly outlined what the Russians were doing at the beginning, many people seem to still believe that the Russians were pushed out of the Kiev area and the surrounding areas of Kharkov. And many of them also forget that the negotiations between the two sides were still happening at this time. And as we've all deduced, the Ukrainian side is not really in charge of their stance in the negotiations. And from my understanding, from Lavrov's words, and Lavrov doesn't just talk for the fun of it, he said soon after that the pulling back from Kiev was a goodwill gesture on their behalf because of the promises of the Ukrainian side during the negotiations. And as soon as that happened, a shift in tactics was perceived, and going back on the agreement was perceived on the Ukrainian side, which basically turned this military operation into phase two. And we have to keep in mind that the phase one objective succeeded in tying down a bunch of troops. You know what I mean? If they hadn't spread out the Ukrainian forces as thinly as they did, the 8 years of fortifications in the Donbas might have been stocked to the brim and a lot harder to even grind down in the sense that they have been doing since. So when they shifted, basically, we should also keep in mind that this battle has been an eye-opener for Russia as well, I think, in the sense that many of the commanders who got into their places because of who they knew or because of favors and whatnot, were noticed, let's put it that way, by their failure to command and the awful troop casualty rates that the Russia experienced, and those people have been rotated out, and it's served as like a cleaning for the Russian army. So now that their forces can rely basically on their command to be people who are supposed to be there, not people who got there as a favor, because of who they knew, they have become a lot more effective. And the other thing is, as Scott Ritter said in the first weeks, the tactics that the Russians showed at the beginning were not the typical Russian tactics. Even now, they're not the typical Russian tactics because of Putin's directive to not strike at civilians. And basically, that's why they're having to go and send, quote-unquote, the Chechens or whoever else, infantry-wise, to clear building to building. And that's why it's taking much longer than one would expect, especially if you've only been exposed to gaming and to movies of you know, Hollywoodized liberations of countries, including D-Day and so on. And then we have to keep in mind that this has been building up for 8 years. The people in Donbass have been at war for 8 years. The special military operation was an escalation, but it was not the beginning of anything as far as the people in Donbass are concerned. We should also keep in mind
I wanted to jump in and say, I mean, you know, like the general idea, I totally makes sense, totally agree with. Like Scott Ritter in particular on that point, however, like to infer two things, like strategic, the history of the tactics and then the kind of undertone of it is just a little bit not I just kind of like, okay, let's note it, you know, it's not alarming or anything, but let's just note that his commentary is that in his opinion that mm-hmm. normal Russian tactics would include a heavy cost of human life. Okay, let me just frame this. Okay, and
much more use of artillery, basically.
And well, they're using more artillery now, but earlier supposedly
they're using it only on the fronts, on the embattled positions. Whereas Ritter says that
that's a fact. Yeah, that's a fact. But like when you look at the tactics that had to be used in the development of tactics from an insurgency, basically like Chechnya, over and then looking at Syria and the Russian advisors there. Like there was a lot of big cities, you know, you have, you know, Aleppo, street to street fighting, and you have Russian advisors and they're learning too. It and the also the different tactics and the use of tanks, you know, that were used in Mariupol, as you know, separate from, like, general conventions or different theories out there. I mean, like, for example, on the use of tanks, for example, some
tanks are obsolete, don't you know?
Right.
everybody's been saying for the last 10 years, 15 years, that tanks are obsolete, and even the British Army is like winding down their. I think that they're planning to phase out the use of tanks completely. So there's different kinds of military doctrine. There's different kinds of military approaches. And right. The thing is that the Russians, like I've watched a couple of former military Russian, educators who basically tell you that there's you know, simple science, simple math that you can do of, you know, how many artillery shells do you need before you can walk in without needing to sacrifice a soldier's life. I'm oversimplifying it, but like the idea is that there is a science behind it. You know, it's not just going in and shooting up a room or a building. And there's a very structured way to approach it, and that's what the Russians are doing. There's no like gung ho. Let's see what happens if we do this, and I wonder what their reaction's going to be. No, like all of it is calculated. All of it is you know, and like many commentators have said, This Ukrainian steppe, or the flat plains of Ukraine, is exactly what the Soviet and now Russian army is designed to fight in. It's not new territory for them. It's not something that they're inexperienced with. Now let's get to like the more serious predictions, let's say, or like expectations that I have for what's going to happen
Oh wait! I want to hold on the forecast until the next
very
hour.
End. All right.
Not the very end. No, not the very end. Just for the next hour. After this one, we're still in.
Let me touch up on another very important history point that I think many people overlook. It's important to remember that during World War II and during the Nazi occupation, we've all seen that photo, that meme of you know, everybody doing the salute, and that one guy with his crossed hands, just like, and be this guy. And everybody always thought they would be that guy, but the time has come, and it's you know, a lot of people are not finding themselves in that guy who stands up to the you know, the status quo. So it's important to remember that everywhere, like from Vichy France to like the Croats, the Greeks, even in Serbia, there was collaborators. There was collaborators who worked with the regime of the occupiers, and these people, or these elements, let's put it that way, have continued to exist. And it is these collection of, you know, hidden and lingering elements of a Vichy-like mentality that is supporting the buildup and the anti-Slav and anti-Russian now sentiment that's leading to this conflict, or that led to this conflict. You know, like from the Western perspective, I have many contacts across the world who, you know, but like, are they really Nazis? And like, do they, like, what did the Russians mean? And like, for when you listen to the Russian perspective and you take into account what we discussed about the casualty rates, you realize that the Russians have a reason to be anxious about it. You know, many Russians will tell you that they don't have many friends or families who were not affected by World War II. So it's something that
it's very different. It's very different in the U.S. You know, where people directly affected by these great wars, it was because of they're related to soldiers who were casualties, right? But yep. The idea of the war affecting and the consequences on civilian population, I think, often kind of just sort of goes, right? You follow what I'm saying? So
yep.
I think now what we're doing, let's see, what we're doing for like the next, for this coming section is going over what the conflict looks like right now, like from the, like, talk about what you think from what you can see from the aerial stuff and looking at what homeboy from Defense Politics Asia says about it.
Defense Politics Asia, I came across his channel just by random. You know, I believe I've beaten the YouTube algorithm where I'm subscribed to such random channels, and I watch such focused things that, like, the YouTube algorithm actually suggests things that are worthwhile most of the time. And basically, it popped up, and I watched his stuff, and it was interesting because he actually goes in and he gives you both stories. He has a sense of humor. He like verifies things from 2-3 sources before he decides what's going on, and he overall gives you an idea you know, we all forget that Ukraine is huge, like huge,
right,
as somebody used to say, huge. Like if you look at a map of Ukraine and you measure the distance from the eastern to the western border, it's actually longer or further from the eastern to the western border than it is from Ukraine's western border to the French border, which is something insane to think about as far as you know, size is concerned.
Right. So
like now we take into account that, like, you know, basically they've taken Florida in these 3 months, from what I understand about size.
England.
Or like a third of Germany, basically. And they've been working in warring in an area where there's been 8 years of buildup, and there's been infinite billions of investment in both arms and training and all kinds of psychological warfare efforts that are still going on. And the constant support that they're getting from people just around the border of Ukraine, hovering in, you know, AWACS and so on and so forth. You have to keep in mind that also in like my view, what's going on is that Russia is trying to do as much as possible with as little as possible. Like, you know, everybody in the West and a lot of people still believe that Russia is going to run out of ammo very soon, and that, you know, Russia is going to have to call up their conscripts and whatnot. But the way I see it, and keeping in mind the Syria conflict, like the Russians, when they went into Syria after like a year in Syria or something like that, they said, hey, did you guys know that it's cheaper for us to go to Syria and like to clean ISIS from Syria than it is for us to go to the other side of Russia, where we have to do our training and testing of our weapons? Like, it was actually cheaper for them. Like, their military expenditure in Syria was less than on their military exercises that are regular, you know? So, and when you take that into consideration, you have to like see that, especially now with the second phase of the operation, quote unquote, the Russians are taking it easy. They're not going all in. They're not pulling out all of their weapons. They brought out, you know, this new weapon, that new weapon. They've seen how it works. They've evaluated it, but they've also kept it secret from, you know, the prying eyes of the West, which are just around the border. And they're constantly picking up on everything, you know, like electronic intelligence, I'm sure, is nonstop scanning and nonstop zooming in and seeing what the Russians are doing and how they're doing it and why they're doing it and how to defeat it. And the Russians, I'm sure, are not stupid and know this. And therefore, they're taking their time and they're trying to do the most that they can with hitting as few civilians as they can. Meanwhile, they're trying to like not show all their cards. Like they don't want to show what's in their hand unless they have to. That's the sense that I get from what's going on and from some sources in the Serbian internet, let's say, sphere.
Well, now, when we look at the developments in, for example, the area north of Slavyansk, right? Mm-hmm. We see how there's movement, there's elimination of the Ukrainian defensive forces, mm-hmm. In the path. You have it basically after Slavyansk is Kramatorsk. The whole thing is heavily mined to hell and back. Apparently Ukraine is the most mine, whatever, you know, mine.
You know, the only thing that I can say when you bring up mines is, yeah, they've had 8 years to build up their the same tactics, mm-hmm. the same tactics that they were using in Bosnia. Like, if you remember the original, like the OG Mujahideen, before terrorists and ISIS and all these terms were coined, the original Mujahideen that were in Bosnia that helped during the breakup of Yugoslavia, which sometimes, you know, depends how deep down the rabbit hole you go, but apparently the original Bin Laden was there as well. He and they also mined a lot of the Bosnian forests, which to this day are still one of the most mined areas in Europe, you know?
Yeah, still, well, it's still an effort to demine it. It's still ongoing.
So saying that the Ukrainian Western-backed, let's say, forces of not good are using similar tactics and in civilian areas. Like, we've all seen the videos of them walking into this woman's backyard and being like, we're going to mine your backyard. And she's like,
right, backyard. Right.
And the soldiers are like, yeah, but the Russians are coming, you know? Like, oh, no. So, there's that. And then there's the actual geography of the area. You know, there are these patches of forests, there are rivers. Then there's, you have to take into account all the, how should I say, sabotage that's been happening on the side of the Ukrainian government. As far as the infrastructure is concerned, you know, like the mines, the dams and the bridges and so on and so forth that have been destroyed in order to both make the civilian population suffer and slow down the Russian advance, basically.
Okay, so Russia jumps in at the beginning, all right? It sets off a chain reaction. It jumps in, you know, around Kiev, Sumy, et cetera, and then, you know, then it pulls out, right, in some strange, highly debated, still debated to this day by people on the internet, tactic. And, some would argue it was already, that maneuver was built, and it is the maneuver, into their, that tactic was built into their strategy, at the start. So I subscribe to that. If you look at what happened and how it was used and so many, all the things that it established in terms of when people talk about predictive programming, now when I'm looking at that front, you know, happening now, Slavyansk, that's people consider that to be symbolic because of to this day continued an incessant whining from Igor Girkin, our favorite Muscovite. But you know, if we were to look at the developments in Severodonetsk now, you know, there's so much fog of war because by the time we hear something, and we live just one country over, right? Also, we have a couple of questions, I'm gonna, the first one is who you are. So yeah, so for those of you joining us now, we're talking to Y, goes by you, and we're not gonna say who he is, but he talked about his some of his background at the start of the show. We won't get into it again, but
in short. A Yugoslav that has 30-ish years of political experience.
And now we're talking about the developments in the different areas, looking at what the situation looks like based on an accumulation of many different reports. So kind of like putting together, and then understanding that some of those different reports can be echo chamber stuff too, right? But so that's why I was always like, okay, how much of that are you weeding out? Looking at things, what's your sense of what's happening now in Severodonetsk? area, the whole Donetsk, the general thing.
Severodonetsk is a tricky situation, but it's methodical. Again, the Russian approach, it's calculated, and it's yielding effects. Whoever destroyed the third bridge, the first two bridges that were connecting Severodonetsk and Lysychansk were destroyed by the Ukrainians. And that kind of already sealed their fate, at least for the ones in that Azot deja vu plant that we're going through now. Those people, whether they're Ukrainian or foreign, are not going anywhere. And we're going to have, like everybody's realizing, a deja vu of the Mariupol. So that's a done deal, you know. I believe Kadyrov, as crazy as he is, but I believe him. It's a done deal. That bank is taken already, and there's reports of even the plant being surrounded as of last night, like on both sides.
Oh, talking about the Azot plant, right?
Yeah. And on the wider, let's say, regional front, from what I've seen, the Russians are slowly going village by village, liberating or taking it, however you want to phrase it, securing it, let's put it that way, and establishing their plan. And the ranges have to be taken into account, because there's, you know, little forests that on Google Earth, when you look at the map of the overview, look like they're a bit of a shrub. But then when you take out the measuring tool, you realize it's 7 to 20 kilometers of forest, you know. And you're not going to take that in a day unless you set it on fire. And the Russians are not there to, like, wage war against Ukraine or against the Ukrainian people. I think Alexander Dugin recently said it best, to paraphrase, I don't want to say that I'm quoting correctly. He said, Russia is not at war with Ukraine or its people. Russia is performing an exorcism of Ukraine. And that's what it is. It's like a military exorcism of Ukraine. Anybody who feels the need to take up arms against Russia is slowly being, you know, ground down. The fact that they opened up so many fronts at the beginning, tied up so much of the Ukrainian army, that it allowed the Russians to set up what they wanted as a game plan in phase two in Donetsk. Okay. And when they pulled back, that gave the Ukrainians the false sense of security that oh, we defeated them or whatever. And now our army is amazing because we have all this Western support, and we're going to send more troops to the east and take care of Russia. And Russia, when all these troops showed up in the east, Russia was waiting for them. It's not like they didn't know they were coming. And, you know, apparently Russia is using 20 times more artillery than Ukraine is. And as of the latest news, the Ukrainian side has run out of Soviet era shells. Like, they don't have any more of those for the artillery. So there's going to be a turning point very soon where, what is this, the fifth mobilization or the sixth that they're pulling up?
Earlier, off air before the show, we were talking about whether this was the fifth or sixth mobilization, and whether that was a mobilization since the 2014. Because I remember, like, the second or third mobilization, occurring towards the end of the conflict, you know, in 2015, and so. I don't know if this fifth or sixth mobilization now is the, because it just seemed like a couple of, it just seemed like last month it was the second mobilization. So I was wondering if that, or maybe that was 2 months ago. So are they, I guess it's ongoing rounds that are going off every month, these mobilizations, or?
I don't know what it means. I'm no expert, and I don't know when they started counting from, like you said, right, whether it's from 2014 or whether it's from February.
Right.
But regardless, they can't keep it up forever. The quality of troops constantly declines, even though you have the same number of troops. It's not the same quality of troops. Regardless of whether it's true or not that they're mobilizing women and or older people, it doesn't matter, because just by the fact that you're having to go and chase these people down, you're obviously getting a lower class of soldier, lower willpower even of soldier, you know?
Yes, uh-huh. Now, when you look at the total losses at the beginning of the conflict, of the Russian conflict, later in the first phase, later it was revealed, like officially, and we don't know what, and we say later it was revealed, that's not the same thing as officially later it was declared. So let's separate that. Later, it was officially declared, some numbers, they seem to be just on around 2,000 or north. South of 2,000, and then that didn't include whatever losses expected to be the same ish, but they weren't reported, at least weren't reported at the time, from the Donetsk breakaway republic or independent republic, and Lugansk.
In so we took them,
yeah.
Honestly, in my experience, discussing numbers of both casualties and losses,
as right, well right, as uh-huh.
and technical uh-huh. stuff,
yeah,
is pointless until about 4 years after the conflict.
Because, right, because it's going to be so much floating information, yeah.
Yeah, because it's in the interest of both sides to, like, fudge the numbers one way or the other, even slightly. And even then, you have to think about the fact that, you know, like, I've heard reports of people from the front, like, you know, them saying stuff to video, that, you know, they go out and... an artillery strike happens as they're advancing, and it takes out five people in a building, and they go in and they see these five people are dead. They don't report them as dead because they got to keep moving to the next building, and they don't break radio silence, and they don't count these people. So there's a lot of dead and casualties, and probably on both sides, that are not being reported. Simply because, you know, they're not discovered until a week later or 10 days later or something. So until it all winds down, I think it's, you know, we can talk about confirmed kills, but then there's a whole different category of, you know, we can't see everything that's going on. Like you said, in short, like, you know, there's the things that we see. And then there's the things that are confirmed, quote unquote, by the both sides. And all of these are subjective to, you know, even the online open source intelligence community. You know, there's these sites that track their losses by pictures and so on and so forth. But, like, you know,
oh, it's trash.
Yeah, how can you guarantee me that, like, the picture of the broken tank from one angle is not the same tank taken from a different angle and, like, moved to a different location, like, 3 days later? You know, like, you can't. And it reminds me of, you know, the Kosovo conflict, or the bombing of Yugoslavia in 99, however you want to look at it, where NATO... And the spokesman would give daily briefings. And, you know, NATO flew these missions. And they'd show you, like, video of the cruise missiles hitting trains, civilian trains. And then they say, sorry, it was collateral damage. That's when they invented the term collateral damage. So the Jamie Shea was the name of the NATO spokesman. He'd come out and he'd say... you know, we destroyed 75 tanks today and 42 armored personnel carriers and so on and so forth. And then you'd add up all the numbers that they would pump out every day. And it was more than Serbia had officially on the territory of Kosovo, you know. And then you're like, that's weird. And then the conflict ends.
It's the same thing, like, when you always... Oh, sorry, go on.
And then the conflict ends and the Serbian army pulls out, and they're missing about 10 tanks. I think I'm exaggerating. I think it was like 4 or 5, but let's say it was 10 tanks that they're missing out of the 1,000 or so, or 500 or whatever that they had on the territory. And it just was like a slap in the face of the propaganda machine that was pumping numbers and numbers and numbers so hard. That's why I'm saying that numbers, you know, take them with a lot of salt. And as Defense Politics Asia says, careful of your kidneys with all the salt that we've been having.
Right. No, I know. You have to be careful of your kidneys. You know, yeah, you can't oversalt, right? But better salt than sugar. But, you know, the thing is that, I got pitched a question just to talk about raising nationalism, how raising nationalism in Russia might remove Putin to put someone more hardcore war territorial gains if he fails to achieve anything other than complete defeat of Ukraine. So like the, you know, I don't know if that's like Kiev has to, they're going to like Russian occupation of and absorption of Kiev, not like Odessa, Kiev, the Odessa, Kiev network, you know, incorporated into the Russian plan.
There's many visions for what is a win, you know.
Okay, but now how would it be? So, but if Putin doesn't, you know, if Putin doesn't meet like the broader ones, are they setting him up? Like, for example, look at like crazy Medvedev's, we're going to say behavior lately, like his complete personality shift. Like, this is like very, very suspicious to me. But I also think that it could work on multiple levels, and it could be like, you know, working on multiple, you know, it could be meant to appear suspicious, and it could be Medvedev doing yet another Medvedev. You see what I'm saying? So, you know, through that way. So it's like as a double, triple.
I don't think there's anything that's happening from the Russian side, including Lavrov's comment about anything, or Medvedev's outburst of like, you know, I'm a teenager who's angry at the West. None of that is not scripted. None of that is not calculated. So, like, it's all like the Russian inheritance of the Soviet mentality and the Soviet government state apparatus, including diplomacy, including military, and so on and so forth, is very calculated. You know, it's not. It doesn't go by whims. It doesn't go by opinions. And I don't think that Medvedev is lashing out. Right. I think if anything, Putin and Medvedev sat down and he was like, "Hey." Come on, do that thing you do. Scare the West.
Yeah.
Scare the West, well, because I can't, because I have to appear as the sober and rational one, because I still got to talk to the Arabs, and I still got to talk to Africa, and I still got to talk to China.
Right.
So like in the meantime, show them, please, like in your Telegram channel, where like it will cause a limited stir, but it won't be official. In the like, you know, official senses, the Medvedev doesn't like the West, and can you blame him? Like, realistically, can you blame him? Because like, let's not forget about biolabs, you know, like we glossed over that on the intro to like why this happened, but like, let's not forget about biolabs. Like, we'll just leave it at that.
Yes. I mean, it's Medvedev, you know, remember the whole thing with Hillary Clinton and the reset button, but the button didn't say reset. Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they pushed the button, and the idea of you know, Medvedev, you know, the Western establishment had these, illusions within Medvedev that he would be more, you know, someone that they liked.
Liberal.
Yeah. And he appeared far more Western in many ways. He even wore Western suits before. He wore like those little skinny suits before anyone else did in Russia,
before, if I recall. It was cool. Yeah. No, let me ask you, what was the ultimate goal of Medvedev being in? Of, I mean, saying from the Russian deep state, like hidden agenda, blah, blah, blah. What was the ultimate goal of Medvedev being in?
Like, you mean, well, you mean in terms of, you mean that it advances, right, that it advances this, well, it shows that there's a hermetically sealed power establishment of which, like, Putin is, you know, strongly involved in leadership and is the public face of it, and maybe even leading it, you know, I don't know, but yeah. There's more than just Putin, you know what I mean?
And, yeah, yeah, but Medvedev's ultimate, like, Medvedev surprised me, you know, going back in time when
right. Well, now, yes, I mean, he had a chance to, I mean, Putin only now with the conflict now and the way that it's been angled and going only has like more like legitimacy and power now. Like at the time that Medvedev could have, if he wanted to, done, and it could have gone bad for him, but he had a strong chance to like actually move against Putin, and the West had was kind of hoping he would, right? And he didn't, and now the situation has changed because Russia is stronger economically, militarily. They're winning in a conflict, and it doesn't make any sense for, you know, Medvedev to be making moves against Putin right now, in my opinion, or like now or anytime soon.
I don't think there's going to be any shift of power. Let's put it that way. In the worst case scenario, if there's like an assassination on Putin and Medvedev takes control, the West is fucked. Like, excuse my French. But like, you know, that's the absurd sci-fi fantasy of like, you know, the West, basically. But like in reality, no, nothing's going to change. Like the only things that's going to happen eventually is Putin's going to give up power willingly when his term or his health or whatever in like 5-10 years starts waning. He's going to pass on power to somebody that's chosen. Like it's as simple as that. Like the Medvedev. The Medvedev reset that took us all by surprise was no more than just appeasing the West to see how far they'd go, and to give more time for Putin to be legally quote unquote in power later longer.
Mm-hmm.
Like Medvedev was. I think just you wouldn't say pawn, but maybe a bishop in chess. You know, he was a placeholder.
Right, but, right.
But just like the bishop in chess, you know, he is not somebody you want to piss off.
Well, I think his posturing is weird, but it's always. Technically, the stuff that you read is you know, represents Russian truth. Sometimes Medvedev sounds like the philosopher who shall not be named. You mentioned earlier by mistake, but we won't edit that. But sometimes he sounds just like that guy, and highly radioactive guy. And what do you think? What do you think then is the situation looking at from the bird's eye view? From the bird's eye view, we're looking at the front again. We kind of go back and forth looking at the front again. You talked about the developments there, but I didn't understand or recall if you talked about it being totally surrounded on the highway or that it's going to be encircled or
it's
how.
Not. It's not yet, but from what I understand, the latest that I've seen is there's about 20 kilometers. So it's under fire control, which means that the Russians can fire at moving things there and have control over who goes in and out. But generally, From what I saw last night, no, they don't. They haven't closed. They've closed the two little pockets. I'm not sure. I don't wanna. TOA. Yeah, it's not looking good. Like everywhere the Russians are making progress, and the Ukrainians. And I think it's by design. I don't think I don't think it's a mistake. I think it's NATO leadership that's cleansing Slav on Slav on purpose.
And, yeah, no. If we talked about this previously, like if obviously this is not the kind of war that the cabal wanted to have. Like even though if it had been the early 90s, then they would have loved to see Ukraine and Russia at a war with each other at that time, because it would have been part of increase the violence and destruction during the collapse of but this is actually like an ascendant Russia that's like reclaiming a hijacked Ukraine that's already lost its sovereignty from over a period of 10 or 15 years.
And it's not only lost its sovereignty, it's lost its identity, it's lost its culture, it's lost
its many of these things, yes. It's been recast under, yes. I mean, it's not that every, every poet and culture, whatever figure of Ukrainian descent from the 18th or 16th century or the 19th century. I mean, that's all part of the richness of that, of these people. But that doesn't mean that they control the government in Kiev right now. They just and it's these people that history has been hijacked and has been saying because there's these people who are historically Ukrainian because they exist, like to assert this culture, we have to oppose Russia. But in the history of the Soviet Union, it was actually the Soviets who built up Ukrainianism and actually built up the Ukrainian identity. You see what I'm saying? And yeah. So the thing about their fact, the what's weird with the kind of like Azov and Adar and right Pravi sector, and also like the common thing said by shock, AM radio shock jocks, and and then for younger people like the under 40 crowd, there's like the whole YouTubers and the podcasters and streamers for people under 50. 60, and they just completely are fat, mentally deranged about the conquest or destruction of Russia or defending Ukraine from a Russian invasion, which through their politics, right, by declaring Russia the enemy when it wasn't, they hyperventilated this situation into existence, in a histrionic fit, actually created they actually summoned into being a war that never had to happen, that they were imagining would happen. So then began to point every, gun, missile, weapon they had at Russia until Russia did something. You see, it was it's the most bizarre, they actually created the present reality through their action, through their negative actions. I think it's one of the most instructive developments that you can also take from your personal life is, when you prepare for the worst thing and all this stuff, you have this mentality of lacking, then you're gonna make decisions that are expecting the worst thing, which are obviously so very conservative, there's no risk involved. And so there's nothing gained, and that's paralysis, right? Now, looking at then the change in media coverage has been amazing. Like in the Guardian, in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, they've republished the admission from the Ukrainian side that they're losing 300 people a day. We know that number's more like this, that includes wounded, so we know that number's more like 700 or 800 or something like that. That includes 400 to 500 being killed every day. Ukrainian side has all but admitted this now. I mean, they're just about two-thirds away, I think, from a something very close to the right number. So it's just, and Russia knows that Ukraine can use this, and Ukraine has used this as a pretext and as a and has attacked Donetsk, the civilian areas in Donetsk, just attacked them, and that has caused a you know big focus and shift of attention on that, which is very interesting in the information war, because now
the French and the German media say that it was the Russians who shelled the Donetsk. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yes, no, they continue to, you know, they'll correct it, like, after it's too late. They'll correct that, like, in a week or two, probably. But yeah, no, that's information war. It's fascinating.
The shift in narrative is worth noting. The numbers, not so much. The fact that the numbers are changing and the numbers are big.
But they're getting closer. I mean, they're getting closer to reality.
We all knew that you know, there are big numbers of artillery pieces and big numbers of soldiers, and we know what happens when they meet. But the shift in narrative is worth mentioning. Also, it's worth mentioning that the online intelligence open source community went silent like 2-3 days ago, at least the like pro-Ukrainian one.
Well, I mean, generally, a lot of open source stuff is generally like this, some weird fixation, or they're kind of like connected to wannabe Western intelligence. Kind of, they're kind of glowing.
Yeah, obviously, they're all projects of certain levels, but it's interesting to note that the timing, you know. The timing is that all this stuff is coming out. It's as if the West, quote unquote, or whoever's in charge of Ukraine, is trying to slowly prepare the ground for a proposal of like a settled peace in Russia. I mean, with Russia, and I don't think Russia's gonna take the bait.
You know, it's like these setups aren't new, and Russia rarely reacts to things, and even Russia is so non-reactive that even its movements into Ukraine, I mean, you know, I don't even follow every fact of the official Russian narrative, because I think they also saw that there were reasons that were opportune for their own, in terms of timing of the, you know, there could have been movements, that could have, you know, set up, but they decided that, and there, I think there were movements set up designed by the Ukrainians to go into effect, probably in the first week or two of March, it looks like, and based on the buildup. Up now that we're looking at it, based upon the buildup of the aerial and looking at the aerial stuff and the buildup of their forces and also the politics, their increase in amassing forces. I mean, they declared that they were going to, or that they had achieved 900,000 people in reserves in their armed forces. Right. And mm-hmm. that's a fairly large, you know, number that's getting up to some high, very high numbers. Now, it turned out that they actually then had invented that number based upon legislation which changed, like, or a declaration that changed the consideration of what was considered to be a reserve. So because they declared so much of the population to be potential reserves, they declared that the number, right? But what that means is that they can then draft them. So then that's what you're seeing now with the forced conscription, is that they have to hit this 900,000 number before they can, you know, even potentially stop drafting people from the public, like going to swimming pools and to churches and stuff, and, you know, basically they're grabbing men off the streets and throwing them into vans to go fight to the front, but they're doing it kind of like chill style. Like they serve them papers and then the police show up like in 5 days if they haven't reported to the office, right? But basically, the reporting offices are going out into the world and just telling and serving papers, right? And there's big fines and prison time involved if you don't pay the fines. Or even, I think, even if you do, people are trying to pay to get out 4,000 to 5,000 euros effectively to get out of having to go, you know, into the military. They're even serving documents on women now. And force conscripting women into the forces. They had already, I think, been getting men over 58 or 60 or whatever the number was. So they had been pulling in men over 58 or 60 for some time, whatever the number was before.
And whatever the number was and whatever the number is and whatever the number that they're aiming for is, there's a number. And once that number is reached, a total collapse of the armed forces is inevitable sooner or later.
Right.
Which means, from our perspective looking at it now, we've got the X amount of people that it takes to reach the number of maximum people that can be drafted and that can be pulled into some kind of effective military unit in Ukraine. And then we've got the number, which is Y, which is the time that it takes for this maximum last final stand of complete resources, exhaustion, being demoralized and pounded by artillery. And we already know that they're running out of ammo, so those people are going to have even less ammo, so they're going to have less morale and less will to fight. And we already know that the tactics of the Russians are effective and that they're not in a hurry. They're not rushing to take anything. They're systematically cleaning and demilitarizing and denazifying, you know, section by section, kilometer by kilometer. And
There was a report recently that ran on the Washington Post or New York Times and it said that I think they're just talking about something that has been closer to the situation for a long time, but now they're saying what they're saying is they act like we're talking about it now because it's new now and not because they're admitting it finally, right? But what they're saying now is how high the losses of the Ukrainians are, that the army's in collapse, that they're losing 1,000 or 500 people a day, and which is like crazy when you extrapolate that out, and that they, you know, that the whole situation is very bad.
The situation is bad. You know, like the collapse of the army can be categorized into many collapses. But the idea is that there's...
But those collapses began in March.
Yeah. But there's collapses in the sense that, you know, people are dying on the front. And then there's collapses in the sense that from the command structure, there's people who are dying. And then there's collapses in the sense that the people who are not dying in the command structure are failing in the command structure. So they're losing, you know, support, both from their higher ups and from their troops.
Yeah, I have to do some self criticism because I gotta find the dudes real fast, you know, on Telegram I'm trying to remember the name of the group that was operating in Severodonetsk, where, you know, the Azot plant is, that these people are in. Today is the surrender day. Today was the first announcement, by the way, of the expected mass surrender day, I think. And so it's happening live right now, but we don't see anybody.
Fast forward
right now. Yeah, right now. It's already
No, I mean, like, compared to Mariupol and Azovstal, these guys already know the script.
I'm not saying that they've surrendered yet, but they just I'm not saying that they've been
but in Azov,
predictive programming is there.
in Azovstal, it took like 2 weeks for them to reach this epiphany. You know what I mean? Here, at least.
No, I'm not saying that these guys are. I'm not saying these guys are surrendering yet. I'm just saying that today is the day that they are allowed to walk out and surrender. But I haven't seen any of that surrendering happen yet. But I've been talking with you, not looking. You know, But I'm just saying that today was the first announced Russian, like, they surrender these guys. And to have a actually, it's the what they're trying to establish is to get the people out first. Sorry, not for the but the guys can surrender. But today is for the to get the people out, and they denied that anyone coming out as people would be allowed out by a third party. Right again, here
I
we
just,
go.
Or, I just right? realized I just realized you were using that word people. Yeah.
Yeah, people, right? People, okay.
I don't know.
To allow people to come out,
and there's
people. These are two different categories, right? Okay, because people is everybody, okay. But yeah. it sounds like civilians, but it's not. People include soldiers. That's the thing. So the Russians said that this is a scheme by the Ukrainians to allow people to avoid surrender. And to withdraw use it as a withdrawal or evacuation technique instead is what the Russians said. So they said they're not going to allow that to happen. And, they denied that request, from the Ukrainian side in the talking about it. Okay. So that's the more recent development, like as of yesterday in terms of the political development of that. But now it's, they're supposed to be allowing civilians to leave. Now, every day they don't allow civilians to leave. Now we should have this humanitarian crisis focus
In the last 2 days, from what I understand, in the last 2 days, that last bridge connecting to the Ukrainian side has been taken out. And as of last night, special forces have been on the other side of the... Let's say
between the two cities, or what?
Factory.
The bridges between the two cities.
Mm-hmm. There's three bridges, two of which were destroyed by Ukraine, and the third of which was, destroyed yesterday or the day before, depends on which time zone you are. But the point is that now there's no physical connection to the Ukrainian side from Severodonetsk to Lysychansk, basically. And that's why the narrative and the vocabulary is not so, the diction is not so important, because all the movement will be happening towards the Russian side. You know?
Right, of course, yes.
Like, everybody who's coming out of there is coming out into the Russians' hands. There's nobody who's going westward,
that's what's being established at today and moving forward, is that there's no evacuations, there's no third party messery, I guess we'll say, to be clean for the kiddies out there, and church ladies. And I think that when you look at what has been said publicly, or by our favorite, Arestovich, that the destruction of the
Goebbels,
destruction of the Ukrainian forces around Severodonetsk would be like sort of the beginning of a chain reaction of defeats, and also then Zelensky said very similar. He said that once Severodonetsk is lost, it's just like a matter of time, and not much time before the Russian
obvious.
Forces at the river, at the
they're
Dnieper river.
The obvious, because Severodonetsk, we should also mention, is very important in the history of the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic's uprising, basically. And it's a key city, and it's the last big city, quote unquote, that needs to be taken in that area. I think that's the Donetsk People's Republic. Therefore, in itself, it's a moral, huge moral blow to the Ukrainian side. I'm not sure how much armor and defensive layering they have in the other city, Lysychansk, but regardless of the level of armor, the on the moral side, the loss, the final loss of that city will be definitely a huge impact on the psyche. And like I was saying before, so we have the X, which is the number of troops, and then we have the Y, which is the time. And once the number of troops reaches its maximum allowable number, the time will run out. And when the time runs out, you're gonna have a collapse of the command structure. You're not only gonna have a collapse of the soldiers and so on and so forth. There's gonna be no army left. There's gonna be, you know, Iraq 2.0, 2.0, if you know what I mean. When they went into Iraq and the Iraq army collapsed and it turned into an insurgency, basically, kind of. It was paid. It was like a subs. It was a subsidized collapse, but like it's gonna be the same thing. There's gonna be a, you know, a lack of direction, a lack of like. There's gonna be maybe pockets of resistance, but they're not gonna be able to hold out against the machine that is the, you know, unrelenting Russian armed forces.
Yes. Go on.
Like. And at that point, when the collapse does happen, the Russians will systematically go in city by city, area by area, kilometer by kilometer, make sure that there's no weapons, check for tattoos, and have their internal security forces, which have already been very active inside the former Ukraine, as you coined, it's interesting to note that recently I saw a video of Crimean internal security forces returning to Crimea, being celebrated, returning from Kherson and other newly liberated internal areas. So the Russian internal security state is already taking care of, you know, these new areas that have come under their domain, which means that once the army achieves its objective of destroying the will and the machinery of war, the internal security forces will just take over and establish security.
Right,
You
right,
know?
right, right. Yes.
And this line will not necessarily be at the front line, because once the front line as a functioning defense collapses, do you want to take a break?
No,
I
continue.
hear something falling in the background. All right, yeah, once the defense line, once the trenches as such, as a military entity stop ceasing to like cease to function, cease to serve their purpose of defense, because of the collapse, the Russians don't have to stay in those lines, you know. And I don't think the Russians will stay in those lines. I think there are many options for what's going to happen to the former Ukraine, but I don't see quote unquote the Russians. Dum dum, use the like, you know, dramatic music, the Russians.
Yeah, the
But
Russians.
yeah, but I don't believe I don't believe they will settle for just Kherson and Mykolaiv and Kharkiv, because they're obviously going to take Kharkiv as well.
Yeah, that's obvious if you look at the situation developing on the front there today, yesterday, around the city. I mean, they're like, I mean, there's no reason to, I mean, obviously they're taking that region.
They're encircling other regions from that region. That's all that needs to be said. The battle that's happening in the Donbass is being waged also from the Kharkiv region.
They wouldn't be taking losses in territories that they didn't, at this point, they wouldn't be taking losses in territories unless they were going to maintain control over the territory.
Going back to the earlier point that, you know, the Russian feint and the withdrawal of troops from the Kiev and other areas, because of the betrayal of the Ukrainian quote-unquote side of the negotiation process, the Russian objectives and goals and, you know, settlement boundaries might have significantly changed from what they originally were. In the sense that, like, if the Russians were originally happy with the, you know, a line that is diagonal across Ukraine, now they might just, or like follows the Dnieper, or like even doesn't even go north from the Dnieper, just goes northeast basically, cutting above Mykolaiv. They might have changed their opinion, you know, and the cultural significance of Odessa, plus the like atrocity, let's call it that way, the like the appalling unhuman behavior that happened there a long time ago when people were burnt alive because they voted. That is not going to be forgotten by the Russian psyche, and it's also not something that they're going to just, you know, forget about. And more and more people are warming up, even Scott Ritter, to the idea that Transnistria is going to also, you know, join forces with the rest of former Ukraine.
Oh, like when with the when the developments where like in Odessa region are more visible or what?
Yeah, when it all winds down, the Transnistria will become a part of whatever is left of Ukraine that is pro-Russian. You know, whatever happens to Mykolaiv and Kherson and Odessa is going to happen to Transnistria as well. Because, like, you know, we all learned, everybody didn't know this, I guess, who was not in the military sphere, but we all learned, I did for sure, that the biggest Soviet ammo storage ever, which, you know, to this day is there, is in Transnistria. It's like enough ammo to wage, I think, a couple of months of World War II.
Yes, it's like, yeah, very, very big amount of ammunition in this ammo storage. It's the biggest ammo storage depot in Europe, and it's in Transnistria. And it's last month, in middle of May, you know, of course, there was a lot of talk from Kiev. They were playing with the idea of like taking it or something. Maybe that was just a couple weeks ago, but it seems like it was the middle of May. But yeah. When we talk about like the XY axis in terms of, or the factors of time and concentration of forces, I mean, you know, what that means is that a tiny army can concentrate all of its force into a single strike upon the opponent that has at that moment in time, at that place, a lesser force, and claim a victory. But that's not the same thing as having and that, and you can use that. And what Ukraine has done is pull these types of stunts. That's where they're getting their victories from. They're not getting their victories in the places that they're taking their losses, right? They're creating opportunities that you can always create, or find rather, fall into, but they're exploiting that they have like still strike forces that can like do things and that are allowed to, that are permitted and fueled to move around to do it. And that's not the, you know, that they reserve their fuel for, you know, for them, right? And then like, so because you can concentrate also in terms of the time and concentration of forces, axis, you can like see that, invariably, like whatever the difference of time, whether it be a couple weeks or a couple months, is the economic and geopolitical situations aren't changing rapidly around Russia at this point. Like it's clear who stands for what and what, you know, what they're willing to do. We've seen what can happen already. And it's probably from the Russian perspective through the worst of it right now. Not that the rest of it is a cakewalk, but they're going to sustain this amount of it while making their gains.
There's the X, there's the Y, but there's also Z, and Z is like a multiplier. It's like you don't add it, you don't subtract it, you multiply it, and you multiply it to the amount of forces. And Z, you can think of it as ammunition, you know, and you can have all the forces in the world. And they can be the most motivated forces ever, but if they don't have the ammunition, they're not going to do much defending, or they're not going to do it for very long. So as far as, you know, after the collapse, you know, there's these elite troops that have the gas and have the ammo and have the newly painted South African armored vehicles coming from North European countries. you know, there's a hope, there's a narrative that can be gleaned from this and can be weaned to create this image of resistance. But the, you know, all you have to do is go see what happened to these kind of elements inside the Russian Federation, whether it be Dagestan or other places, which were taken out with the brutal hand of the internal security forces, and to think that some elements of sabotage or whatever are going to or hardcore troops of, let's say, 300 or 3,000 soldiers are going to stop a Russian advance or a Russian completion of their objective, you know, is laughable, basically. You know, to think that Russia is not going to take Odessa because it's a nest of 3,000 or 5,000 hardcore troops. We saw what happened in Mariupol.
So, you know? So Odessa definitely in the thing. Kharkov is a population of 1.4 million. It's not a village or something.
Apparently that Serbian politician who went to Ukraine, who's pro-West and pro-NATO and pro-whatever, pro-separatist here in Serbia as well. He went to Kharkov and he says it's 70% empty, the city. Like he was reporting, like, oh, poor people there. They so the city of itself is 70% empty.
Yeah, you can look at, when you look at the like the satellites or the maps from either side right now show pretty much the same thing. I mean, the Russians have it like 2/3 surrounded or something like this, right? What does it look like? Or half surrounded? Or what does it look like? Fresh me up.
From what I remember of the Kharkiv front, the Russians pulled back to the border north of it. But recently, because of Ukrainian incursions of special forces and or artillery, so-called cross-border raids into the Russian actual territory, the Russians have beefed up border, let's say, buffer zone that is slowly starting to develop into the exact lines that they did the combat reconnaissance with during the first weeks, when they also took, let's say, line of control around parts of Kharkiv, which allowed civilians even back then to leave. And from what I understand, the sound of artillery in Kharkiv is only increasing. And that's not from Gonzalo Lira. That's from other people in Kharkiv.
Yeah, the line of control or the line of contact would have always been the more stable areas. But a lot of maps at the beginning of the conflict showed the areas of the of combat taking place that were of reconnaissance of a reconnaissance nature ultimately.
At the end of the day, the way I see it, Chernobyl to Transnistria is probably going to be Russian, and everything east of that. Now, when we say Russian, what do we mean? Or when I say Russian, or what do I think I mean? Some parts of that will be like Crimea, outright parts of the Federation of Russian States. Other entities or former states of the former Ukraine, and as a Yugoslav, as a person who was born in Yugoslavia, which doesn't exist anymore because of NATO aggression, and you know, other conspiracies and reasons, I don't say the former Ukraine lightly. You know, it's not like a haha, the former Ukraine. It's like, I feel you, bro. Been there, done that, got the t-shirt. And it sucks. But the reality is that in the former Yugoslavia, you know, some states like Slovenia, which we can think of as, you know, that Wallachian part of Ukraine, will break off peacefully. Whereas...
Oh, right, because they break off peacefully, right.
The parts like it's already happening. That guy, that leader of that area, he's not exporting fuel. He's not exporting, like, donated fuel from Europe is ending up in that region and not being exported to the rest of Ukraine, which is just like, you know, when's the Vatican gonna approve that? Because the Vatican was the first entity that approved Slovenia's withdrawal from Yugoslavia. Wallachia is gonna probably end up doing something similar. You know,
yeah, I mean, but what does that mean? It was the Council of Rome that hatched the plan to how they were gonna destroy Yugoslavia. You know, back in the '70s.
And other conspiracies, but let's not go into it. The point is that Wallachia, or, you know, West, or whatever, however it's pronounced, I'm not even sure that's what it's called, the area of Western Ukraine, or Galicia, or they're going to become states, of their own. But what's going to happen to the buffer zone? What's going to happen to the in-between area? And, you know, Yugoslavia or the geographical area of the former Yugoslavia gives you a good idea that you know, there's going to have to be Bosnia and Herzegovina and Sarajevo, you know. And the way I see it is that that's going to be Kiev. The Kiev and, like, you know, the surrounding area, everything on the west side of the Dnieper River near Kiev is going to be this city-state that is neither eastern nor western, but has you know, UN or something else controlled government, much like Bosnia does.
Right. I mean, but Bosnia effectively is like a uses the MI6 Muslim Brotherhood structures, like both in its like parliamentary politics and its paramilitary and even military, that presents a problem, of course, for the Republic of Srpska. But yes, now in looking at the reality now then of in the Zaporizhia region, do you think they're going to push north to like for, or do you think they're going to change the borders, or is that related to the are moves there related to the efforts that have to come later in relationship to the adjacent region? What is it, Dnipro Petrovsk, what is it?
Dnipropetrovsk, I think. Hold on, let me open up.
Yeah, but yeah, but is that the idea that they have that because when you look at the map, when you look at the line of contact that runs in this on the south mm-hmm. of the conflict, you see that not all of that of Zaporizhia region is like
liberated.
Liberated, as you can see, if you want.
Quote unquote. Yeah,
this is a Russian takeover, you know. But you know, haha, that's just me, you know. But you know,
it hasn't been invaded.
You can't trust what these Russians are doing, let me tell you. But visit Russia before Russia comes to visit you. Let's Basically. See. All right, now. So, in the southern part of the conflict, how do you see that evolving? Because you think that the whole region is going to be, you think that the whole adjacent region, all the way to the river, is going to be part of this Russian Federation ultimately.
Well, whether it's going to be de facto or de jure, it's a point of debate, but it's going to be definitely a buffer zone of sorts. Because there's no reason for
a buffer zone or a pro-Russian state. I mean that's very different. I mean, you know, we're talking. Is it going to be like Donetsk, or is it going to be like this little city-state with some land around it for Kiev?
We don't know. Ultimately,
yeah, we don't know. We don't know. But I mean,
I'm saying you don't think about Donetsk.
You think it's unknown?
Like even now, Donetsk has a totally different storyline than the Kherson region, you know. Like, for example, the Kherson region already has a calling code, whereas Donetsk doesn't. They already have Russian SIM service, whereas Donetsk just got it recently, you know. So is the Russian plan to have like the Donetsk People's Republic, which is just like a Russian affiliated state in the middle of like the Azov Sea, the Russian Sea,
right? No, it's of course. I mean, that I see what you're saying, but I mean,
we
I don't
know
disagree
if it's
with it
be
because Kherson is like an extension of Crimea, but it's going to be a Russian state. It's not going to be like an independent republic.
Yeah, but we don't know. We don't know whether Donetsk is eventually going to be absorbed into the Russian Federation. It may, but it may not. So Going by that, the other former Ukrainian states like Dnipro, Zaporozhye, Poltava, I'm looking at the map here, and like Sumy, let's not forget Sumy Oblast, are all going to be on the, like, you know, scale of independently pro-Russian to like absorbed into the Russian Federation. Because I don't see why Russia, like, if you look at a map of Ukraine and you see where Russia and Belarus meet, I don't see why Russia wouldn't continue this border down. Because when you take out the military factor, which happens, as we discussed, X, Y, and Z, but it happens, you've got all the bargaining chips and you are, you know, drawing the lines on the map. You are Sykes-Picot, so to speak, you know? So why would you not implement something that's beneficial both in a security perspective, geopolitically, and in regional resources plus population perspective? Kiev becomes like a Sarajevo, which is ruled by all and governed by nobody, you know. The other former republics become a geographical pro-Russian buffer to the new Russian border, which absorbs some of them or doesn't, depending on the, you know, political appetite at the time. But I think Mykolaiv is closer in line than Zaporozhye.
Say that again. I think
Mykolaiv mm-hmm. as a city is closer in line for its due date of having Russia visit than Dnipro or Zaporozhye.
Right, but the rest of the territory of Mykolaiv is like the rest is more. You know, I mean, I think ultimately there's like at the time 90,000 or something Ukrainian soldiers along the southern front, but I don't know about I don't think that's the same military district as the forces in Mykolaiv. I'm not sure, but they have 90,000 altogether, like in along the line of contact, like through Zaporizhia and the, you know, the rest of the numbers, as we were saying,
basically mean nothing to us, because like, okay, somebody somewhere estimated there's 90,000, but what does this mean? How many of them are actually holding guns? How many of them are drivers? How many of them are medics? How many of them are?
Yes. Yes. You know, you're talking cooks. About like what they have.
Let's not forget the cooks.
About
they have
force
a high
multipliers and their, what equipment they have and stuff. I'm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
yeah.
So there's like we can discuss numbers, but they're pointless. It's just like the ideas and the general directions of where I see this going. Like at the beginning, how it went. If the Ukrainians settled, it would have been a different story. It would have been a totally different story. But the Ukrainians didn't settle, and what's more is that, you know, I don't know if you saw that Russian permanent representative to the UN discuss Ukrainian education. And when you have a look into what's been fed to the Ukrainian people for the last 8 years, at least, and who knows how much longer, as like in Patrick Henningsen's videos, he interviewed this old lady who was saying like the hate from the western side of Ukraine started even the SSR times, USSR times, but it's gotten much worse in the last 8 years. So like what you realize is that, you know, this like east-west divide of Ukraine existed and it's been brewing, which is, you know, similar to the Yugoslav idea and similar to the Syrian idea and similar to the Libyan idea and what they tried to do in Iran and so on and so forth. It's like basically what the plan it was for Russia to, like, you know, distrust and hate between the ethnically diverse but cohesive cultures. And unfortunately, in Yugoslavia, it worked, and they got like 7, 6, depends who you ask, countries out of it. Here in Ukraine, they were forcing it. They were forcing Russia's hand, and Russia, you know, when I tried at the beginning to explain to some of my not so politically oriented friends that this is not really an invasion, it's a self-defense move, because if I have a brother and my brother has a new friend and his new friend keeps telling him that I'm a bad guy and that I want to kill him and convinces him to sit next to me and to put a knife through my throat so that if I move he can defend himself really quickly, then my brother has been poisoned, you know, by evil rhetoric, because I don't want to kill my brother.
But, yes,
but I need to take that knife out of his hand and calm him down and teach him that, like, you know, Russians are not orcs who live on, you know, the blood of children and so on and so forth.
No, it's a crazy thing. I think that's a lot of the, I mean, I think that the majority of Ukrainians don't think that they are going to be enough, you know, really worse off living with being with the, you know, Russian government talking about in the eastern part of the country, in the southern part of the country, in Odessa region, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when they compare the conditions today in Ukraine, I mean, prior to the war today, like 2019 or something, or 2020, and the complete subordination of Zelensky's, you know, he's handed the state over to the World Economic Forum and the IMF. They've been, I mean, Poroshenko did a lot with that too, with the IMF. I mean, the amount of special money that they had to go in into the country to get the war sustained and going in the first place, you know, and this was like 2014 Russia. And in 2014, Russia had less capacity than 2022 Russia. And the situation has changed so much and such, because that's quite a bit of time, actually. That's 8 years, you know, and that's sufficient time to transform, you know, I mean,
a psyche.
A collective mentality towards a national mentality towards a question. So, but also to prepare for the development of the, you know, of the offensive of what we see now, you know, you can understand on the Russian side why they continue to maintain like 85-90% support for the operation. And they've you know, been, I think, as you said earlier at the beginning of the show, and just sort of as we get close to closing, Russians have a lot of space to move. I mean, they're using a very small, well, you know, I mean, not small, not tiny, but they're only using like a quarter or something of their, or a third of their, or fifth or something of their numbers.
I think it's 10-15% of their permanent forces that they're like
15%. Yeah, so
like tops.
Like they're using a sixth. Yeah.
And the narrative, at least among
Their equipment, how much of their equipment are they using?
Even less. Now even less, apparently, because most of the, you know, the narrative at the beginning was that 200,000 Russian troops are on the border.
Yeah.
Most of those 200,000 are still in Russia.
Right.
They're being rotated in and out, you know, like they have combat duty and then they go out and then they chill in Russia for 2 weeks and then they come back. So like, let's say it's 210,000, then it's actually divided by three, comes out to around 70,000 Russians that are in Ukraine at any time. You know what I mean? That are being rotated in and out of the combat line. Because it's not the same Russian who went in a month and a half ago who's still sitting in his tank. Like, these are regular troops.
Say your number again.
I'd say about a third of the 20,000, of the 200,000, or let's say 210,000. So a third of that is around 70,000. So
right.
I'd say that the combat troops on the line at any point around 70,000, where there's the first line, the second line, and then there's the line in reserves that's taking a break, that's been on the front last month, you know?
Yeah, getting R&R. Yeah.
Basically. So all these numbers that we're seeing are speculations and deductions and estimates based on satellite and whatever, but nobody knows. Like, the Russians know, the Ukrainians might have an idea, but they don't know. And the same way that the Russians don't know how many people they're facing in each pocket, they have an estimate, they can hear chatter, but they don't know until they go and they take the pocket. You know what I mean? So regardless of the numbers, the firepower advantage was and always has been on the Russian side.
Artillery side, what are they claiming right now? 20-1 advantage? 20-1.
And that's artillery pieces. It's you know that most recent Begmanding episode that they had?
Yes. Zelensky went and Begmanded, yes.
I don't know who it was, but the 500 tanks one. And like 1,000 artillery pieces or something like that. I watched last night Ritter discuss it, and he said that the U.S. Army does not have 1,000 active duty artillery pieces. There are like the U.S. Army does not have 1,000 artillery pieces in its active service. So,
right. I mean, U.S. military is not designed for a land war.
For European open plains land war, which the Soviet and its inheritor, the Russian army, are very much designed for. So that's just artillery pieces. That's not ammunition. And apparently the ammunition, the amount of ammunition that the Ukrainian side is using per week, the Russians use in a couple of days. We're talking about the Grad rockets, the like hail, quote unquote.
Yes.
So, you know, the Russians are sparing men and not sparing ammunition. Whereas the Ukrainians, whether by design or by necessity or by desperation, are doing the opposite, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's a situation... on the front right now for Ukraine is desperate, and I think that basically sums it up. And also for the morning for us, and I want to thank you for coming on. We've been talking with you. Sometimes appears in the comments section. We will not disclose his identity, but he spoke a little bit about some of his proclivities and expertises. You didn't really actually explain, you didn't get anything biographical. Maybe we'll keep that a mystery. If we keep you on, if we have you on again, I think I hope you will. You can tell us more. You can reveal more about yourself then without getting yourself arrested or whatever. Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Yes. Say it again.
Thanks to everyone for listening, and thank you for having me.
Oh yeah, no, it's been pleasure's been all mine. And all right, we're gonna get this on the drive, and we'll talk to everyone tomorrow. All right.